Okay, so here we are on March. What day is it? March 22nd, 2026, to talk about Milarepa. I'm not Milarepa, Shantideva. Same number of syllables. Are people generally, we're going to do our prayer in a minute. Are people generally familiar with Shantideva? Like, have you read some of his verses? You generally know who he is. Hi, Michelle, and dog. What's your dog's name?
Francis.
Francis. Okay.
Because
Hi,
he came with
Francis.
a brown hoodie and it looked like a Franciscan friar.
Oh, nice. Okay. People generally familiar with Shantideva? I know Teragar ran a course on it, a year-long course on Shantideva, 2 or 3 years ago. And it followed some of it. I wasn't able to participate fully, but that's there as a resource if anybody wants to explore further, among many other books that one could read. Anybody ever heard of Shantideva? Okay, I know some of you know Shantideva. Okay, I'm not an expert on Shantideva, so this is really just a like an exploration. I've started translating some of the verses, mostly during the Teragar course, and I've done some more lately. But I'm not an expert on Shantideva, so we're just gonna look at the verses and see what they tell us and what our response is to them. So let's. Do I have screen share capacity? Not yet. Okay.
You will. Are
Then do
you?
it second to the
All right,
third.
there we go. Okay, you should be able to do it momentarily, whatever.
Okay, great. Yep.
So.
Yep, we got it. Okay. Here come the prayers. Before we actually recite the prayers, let's take a moment. Just a couple of prayers we're going to do. Let's take a moment to let our minds settle. I think we all know what that means, so we'll just let it happen. And if your mind doesn't feel settled at the end of our mind settling moment, no problem. It is definitely more settled. Your attention is more attuned. Okay, we'll start with the Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer, once in Tibet and twice in English. O Sangje Chö Thang Sok Chi Chok Nam La Chang Chö Bar Du Dak Ni Chab Su Chi Dak Yi Chin Sok Chi Pe Su Nam Chi Drolla Penchir Sangje Drupar Sho. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through practicing the six perfections, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through practicing the six perfections, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. I forgot to check. Everybody can see the screen share, right? I'm going to take that as a yes. Somebody probably put their thumb up. Okay. And let's do the short supplication to the guru. And in particular, I mean, we can think of whoever our guru is, whoever our connection with Buddhism is. But we can also think we're inviting Shantideva to be present. We'll talk a little bit about who he was and a little bit about the book, and then we'll launch into the verses. And we can think that Shantideva, in whatever form he may be in, or whatever formless state he may be in, many centuries after his earthly lifetime, that he's present with us. Okay, we'll just do this one in English. Really thinking that Shanti Deva is here, and all the lamas can be here, the Buddha can be here, Chenrezig Zitar, Medicine Buddha, they're all here. And we're receiving their blessing for this practice. Oh, Dharma, Lord, kind Guru, please know me. See me with compassion's eyes, I pray. Bless me that unborn appearances of confusion based on ignorance vanish into the empty expanse, and I recognize the natural face, Dharmata, things as they truly are. Guru, please bless me to realize this. Let's chant it one more time. Hopefully without coughing. Dharma, Lord, kind Guru, please know me. See me with compassion's eyes, I pray. Bless me that unborn appearances of confusion based on ignorance vanish into the empty expanse, and I recognize the natural face, Dharmata, things as they truly are. Guru, please bless me to realize this. Because this is what the point of all our practice is, right? Is to realize the way things truly are. All the paramitas, especially the paramita of wisdom, which they become paramitas when they become infused with recognition of the empty nature of all our experience, the empty dreamlike nature of all our experience. So that's always what we're working towards when we do Dharma practice. And we're asking now Shanti Deva through his wisdom and compassion to help us realize that. Okay, so is everybody gonna want a break? I'm fine with no break, but sometimes people would like a break about halfway through. We finish up at 4. Anybody feel like they would like to have a break?
It's during.
You mean at 3 or so?
Yeah, around 3 or so, yeah. We'll see. I'll ask then if I remember, or if anybody needs one and I forget to ask. Just let me know. So Shanti Deva was born in 8th century India, long time ago. That's the same century when the Dharma was brought from India to Tibet. Shanti Deva didn't go to Tibet, but other teachers did, most notably Guru Rinpoche. So this is about the same time as Guru Rinpoche was alive. And like the Buddha, Shanti Deva was born a prince. He was going to inherit the throne of his kingdom in India. And they say that at the last minute, he realized that that was not what he wanted to pursue. So like the Buddha, instead of sticking around to be coronated as the king, he instead fled to give up worldly life and seek the ultimate truth. And then so apparently he lived as a renunciate in India for some time, and eventually he became a monk at Nalanda University, which was the largest and most powerful monastery in India in the 8th century and beyond. At his ordination, he was given the name Shanti Deva, which means God of peace in India. I mean, in Tibetan, it's Shiwala. Shiwa means peace, and La means God or deity. he's also, so what we know about him comes from a couple of biographies that have survived. One is by Tarinata. Some of you are familiar with Tarinata. Hagiographies, that's the kind of biography you have of people you consider enlightened, and it sometimes they're not. We can't know how literally true they are. So we don't know how accurate, like in terms of what we would think is accurate in our culture, how accurate it is. But it's really interesting story, which I'm going to share briefly. So according to Pema Chodron, so there's a couple of for further exploration, there's a couple of commentaries on Shantideva. There's one by Pachwa Rinpoche that I have not read, translated by the Padmakara Translation Committee, which is very good translators. There's a commentary in one of the books of like the translations of the book by David Chappell, David Karma Chappell. And the Dalai Lama wrote a book, has a book about him, about this book, and about him, A Flash of Lightning in the Dark of Night. And Pema Chidron also wrote a commentary, and she says also she's not an expert on Shantideva, but his verses really affected her, and she studied them a lot. So same boat as me, more or less. You know, she's Pema Chidron, but that she said she did workshops at Gampo Abbey, but she considered them just her studying along with everybody else. Her book on the Way of the Bodhisattva, which the translation she uses is also Padmakara Translation Committee. Do they call themselves committee? Translation group. Is called No Time to Lose. And that it's one of the verses we'll do today, which is one of my favorite verses. No Time to Lose doesn't say it exactly, but I think it's a reference to that. All right, so so Pema Chidron says in her, she has an intro to the book, the topic, and she says that Shantideva was not well liked at his monastery. He is not a popular guy. And why is this? Well, I don't know anything about his personal characteristics, but Pema Chidron says that he was considered a slacker who didn't study or practice or do his share of work. We've all experienced that person, right? We might even be that person. But if we're not that person and someone else is that person, we know how that would feel. Every monastery has at least one. Every three-year retreat has at least one. So legend has it that to teach him a lesson, and this is the great story, his fellow monks goaded him into giving a talk to the entire university. Nalanda is a huge university, thousands and thousands of monks. So they goaded him into giving a talk to the entire university. Maybe they just invited him. I don't know. They had to goad him. and he would have to sit on a throne that they had made like really, really high with no stairs to get to the top. And I think they're, according to Pema Chidron, they assumed he didn't know anything because he didn't seem to study or practice or do anything, and that he wouldn't even be able to get on the throne in the first place, and that he wouldn't have anything to say. And they hoped he would be embarrassed into actually studying, or maybe they hoped that he would be so humiliated that he would leave the university and they'd be rid of him. instead, he agreed to do it. And instead of what the monks had expected to happen, he is said to have effortlessly ascended the throne. I think it's not specified how he got there, but I think we've seen that in some of our teachers. Like, how did they get there? How did they do that? And he asked the thousands of monks who were assembled in the shrine hall whether they wanted traditional teachings or something new. Like, what would your answer be? They wanted something new. Like, first of all, they didn't think he was going to produce anything. But, like, why wouldn't you ask for something new? They've heard the traditional stuff, probably. They've probably practiced that a lot. So he began by clarifying that the content wasn't what was new, because it was the Buddha's teachings. He's not like going off and like going off the rails and teaching something else. It's the Buddha's teachings. It's the form that's novel. And then he proceeded to recite the entire text, which is very long. It's like over 900 verses. Nobody's exactly sure exactly how many verses, because there can be different versions that have survived in different places, like, you know, an extra verse here or a verse less there. and it's written in poetry. One of the references I looked in called it a long poem, but to me it's not really a long poem. It's like it's just a collection of like verses that are kind of like maxims, like very pithy advice and instructions about practice and about how we could how we should comport ourselves in the world as aspiring bodhisattvas. And they are written in a style, well, some of them are written in a style that's really sort of intimate and even playful. And those are the ones I really like. I don't like all of them. That would be an acquired taste. Many of them are very traditional kinds of views, like ways of looking at the Buddha's teachings. Like there's lots and lots of verses on counteracting attachment by just thinking about the gross aspects of the human body and so forth. There's a lot of fire and brimstone kind of things in there. And so I don't foresee myself ever translating all the verses, because many of them really don't particularly speak to me, even though they're true. I mean, we heard a lot of more of these kinds of teachings back when the Tibetan Lamas were first here and they taught the way they taught in Tibet. And we heard a lot about the 8 hot hells and the 8 cold hells, a lot of detail on those things. So those are not the verses that speak to me so much, but there are a lot that do. And I'll get into that a bit more later, but back to Shantideva, the last thing that I have from Pema Chodron's description of his life, is it said that as he began to teach the wisdom chapter, so it's 10 chapters organized into 10 topics, and the last one is wisdom, which is a paramita. It's really the paramita of wisdom. So as he began to teach on emptiness, on the dreamlike nature of all experience, he levitated upward until he was no longer visible. He was just a voice reciting the verses. And afterward, he became a wandering yogi, and the monks got their original wish never to see him again. He disappeared. And so be careful what you wish for. They probably would have liked him to stay once they saw what an amazing teacher he was. So we can be wrong about that person that we're judging harshly at work or in the monastery or in three retreat. You have to really keep an open mind. It could be Shantideva. You just never know. Anybody here could know more about Shantideva and these verses than I do. You just don't know about people's capacity. I remember there's a line in this biography. Some of you may know it. What's her name? Karma Sonam. I think she's the nun, really pioneering nun in the West. She did like 12 years of solitary retreat at KTD Monastery in New York, back like in the 70s and 80s, under the direction of Kempo Kartar and the 16th Karmapa. And so there's a little biography of her. I think it's written by Victoria Huckenpaller, who's like a member of the DC Sangha. And it's very small books, more like a big brochure or something, like a booklet. And one of her observations after she had done these 12 years of retreat, and she gave up her monastic vows. She said she just wasn't going to be able to represent as a monastic. She went back out into the world. And one of her observations, her quotes in the book is, anybody on the street could be more enlightened than I am. Like, you just don't know. So that's one reason we refrain from judging others as much as we can. Anyway, so on to the book. Shantideva wrote 2 books, and they were both training for bodhisattvas, like for people who wanted to be a bodhisattva. And the other, one of them I'm not familiar with, and it's not, I don't think anybody's that familiar with it. They're experts on Shantideva would know it, but it's not widely studied. But this one, it's the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. That's the Sanskrit name. The title is translated in various ways. This is the Padmakara translation group. He calls it the Way of the Bodhisattva. Stephen Batchelor, who did the pioneering translation, still probably my favorite, 1979, called it A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And David Chipel, Kempo David Karma Chipel, who's a well-known translator from Tibetan. And he wrote the most recent one that I'm familiar with. The most recent translation is called Entering the Way of the Bodhisattva. And all of those are correct titles. I think my personal preference, though probably no one will ever call it this officially, is just how to be a bodhisattva, or even how to bodhisattva. I mean, it's just as accurate. It's training in how to be a bodhisattva. If we want to be a bodhisattva, what do we have to do? this is it. In a very big nutshell, more than 900 verses. So this text is still studied widely in both the Mahayana and Vajrayana traditions. And there are lots of commentaries and lots of translations. And those are three. The three that I just held up are ones that I rely on. And I'll have a handout that Jean can post on the website on the event listing that people can, if you want to read any of these books, a list of a few resources and other information. Patril Rinpoche wrote a comment. Do people know who Patril Rinpoche was? He wrote Words of My Perfect Teacher, which is like the jewel ornament of liberation in the Nyingma tradition. And that Nyingma and Kagyu are very close. And he wrote a commentary on it. He was in, I think, 18th century. I forget, 18th or 19th, I think it's the 18th century. Anyway. He wrote a commentary on it, and he is said to have taught it hundreds of times to anybody who would listen. Like, he would just go out and find people who wanted to know, like what Shanti Deva said. Pema Chodron says it is the essential guidebook for fledgling bodhisattvas, those spiritual warriors who long to alleviate suffering, their own and that of others. Thus, it belongs to the Mahayana, the school of Buddhism that emphasizes all-inclusive compassion and the cultivation of our flexible, unbiased wisdom mind. I mean, it's the heart of Mahayana teachings is, I would say, the six paramitas, which we're studying now. And this book encompasses all of them, although it's not organized exactly as I would organize it now in my culture with my background. Like, I think, like a lot of the verses in the patience in the like alertness chapter, which I think would correspond roughly to ethical conduct, I think should be in the patience chapter. Generosity doesn't have a chapter, but there are lots of verses about generosity here and there. So it might be frustrating or interesting to read it thinking that like you're reading it paramita by paramita, because it's not. It doesn't really fit. A lot of it doesn't really fit like that. We're going to see that when we look at the verses. right. So she says, somebody, I guess that wasn't Pema Chodron, described it as a long poem, whereas I see it as individual maxims in verse form, describing the process of enlightenment from the first thought to full Buddhahood. Last chapter is the wisdom chapter. First chapter is the benefits of bodhicitta. Like, why should we even want to cultivate bodhicitta? And then how do we do it? And then more refined, how do we do it, you know, through these various lenses of patience and perseverance and meditation and wisdom and so forth. several chapters. Early chapters praise the qualities of bodhicitta and provide advice on how to maintain and strengthen it. And then several chapters are about specific paramitas, and I already said this part is not organized in the way that I would probably organize it with my background. So it's just kind of a mixture. Just read it and enjoy it verse by verse. I find many of the, we talked about this, I find many of the verses very inspiring, and some of them like less so. Shanti Deva sometimes uses humor and playfulness to make a point that is easy to relate to. It's like Mingyur Rinpoche's use of humor, especially in the early years when he was teaching in the West. He just got our attention with, like, it's almost like a stand-up comedy routine, but it really riveted your attention, and then he zinged you with the Dharma. You know, it's in this really painless way, so different from the teaching style of the older lamas, the more traditional lamas who had come over. Anne was there. Anne, you were there at that first. The first time he taught at the monastery. Jean and Bruce, you might have been there too, probably. It was 2002 or 2003. We had a field trip from New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Sangha. So he sort of zings you like Mingyur Rinpoche with humor and playfulness in some cases. There's just sort of this lighthearted, fresh quality about the way he presents the Dharma. So it's easy to relate to, but it's also very profound and often very difficult to practice. And it sounds really, you know, sort of fun, And to actually practice it, like the stick of wood verses, I see Anna's nodding her head. It's like the stick of wood verse is very difficult to practice that, but it's really the image just really gets your attention. Let's see. So my recommendation about these verses, about this book, whether you read the whole book or not, is whatever verses speak to you, even if it's only a couple of them, memorize them. I mean, that's why I did my translation, because I feel like it goes in. If it's in verse, most of the translations that have been published are sort of technically in verse. They're broken into four lines, but they're really prose. Padmakara, the Way of the Bodhisattva, they do better with getting some meter involved sometimes. But mostly everybody else, you could just do it as prose, and nobody would know that you could break it into four lines. Right. Oh yeah. So learn some verses. Learn one verse and say it a lot. Like just recite it a lot, like throughout your day. And then it goes in. Like that's how it goes in. Like just hearing it and talking about it today, you'll get something out of that. But if you really take some of it to heart and memorize it and use it in your life, that's where the payoff is. That's how you train as a bodhisattva. And Pema Chodron also, like I've said, not all the verses speak to me. She also says that she had heard it was really great, and so she wanted to study it. And she said she did not fall in love with the book immediately. It took her many readings to really, quote, appreciate the urgency and relevancy of these teachings and see how they can inspire ordinary people to really make a difference in the world. So that's it. And so what is his basic message? It's the same as the basic message of the Buddha Dharma in general, which is that if we aspire to help others and we aspire to bring peace to the world or contribute to peace in the world, like what do we have to do? Like what do we have to do to do that? We have to bring peace to our own mind. We have to learn to not get caught up in our own anger, not caught up in our own attachment, not get caught up in our own impatience. We have to work with our own mind. And that's how we can effectively work with others and work with the world situation. So like the jewel ornament, like Words of My Perfect Teacher by Padma Rinpoche, this is a guide to the entire path. It's a how-to manual, but in a sort of fresh style. So anybody have any questions or anybody have anything they want to share about Shantideva or any response to anything I've said before we look at the verses? Okay, the floor is always open if anybody does have something they want to say, and I'm going to share the text. Sit. Yes, there we go. Okay, can everybody see the screen? And is it big enough? Do you want me to make it any bigger, or is it all right? How is it looking for you guys at Palpung Champen Tarchin?
Lama, could you make, like, maybe you could make the all those toolbars go away? Do full screen, in other words.
I'm not in PDF. It's not a PDF. How can I make my document full screen?
Go to view.
Okay.
Say full screen. I think that would make it bigger.
Read mode, maybe read mode.
Maybe not. There you go.
Okay.
Is that what we should be looking
at? Yeah, that's great. I didn't know about that. That's really good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let's make it one. There we go.
Oops.
No. Yeah, this is now.
Actually, when for us on this computer, it was better the other way. Even with two pages up, it was. But I don't know if that works for everybody. Like if you're on a phone or something, I don't know.
Yeah, let's see. If I made it bigger, it might come as one page. I'll just, oh yeah, it's gone down a bit. Haha, there we go.
Yep.
Okay, still good? Thanks, Jean.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so can everybody see it okay?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, let me see if I can get everybody on the screen here so I can, there we go. Okay, now I can see all of you. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so translator's disclaimer. This will be a handout. I will send this to Jean for the website. I'm not an expert on Shantideva, I already said that, and I have merely translated a few of my favorite verses over the years to the best of my ability to make them easy to memorize. And so these verses are in different states, and they're not entirely consistent in the way they're presented. Some I've broken the words into syllables, and some I have not. Some I did a long time ago. Oh, typo. Oh, well, I'll fix that another time. Some verses feel more or less final to me. Some are in progress. They're earlier translations. When I am translating a text, a keystone of my methodology is that I gather as many translations as I can, and I compare all of them, and I make sure, like, my translation might be very different, like an expression, but I make sure it's in line with the meaning. I don't go outside of the meaning of the way that other people have translated, that have published translations, which have been vetted, basically. So that's how I make sure I'm not just going off on my own thing. People don't always disagree, though. There's one verse in here, I don't know if we'll get to all of them, one verse in here that I ended up translating it. I just did this in the last couple of days. I realized after trying to translate it that it has more than one interpretation, like different translators had interpreted it differently. It's in the wisdom chapter, which is so challenging to translate, in part that Stephen Batchelor, the first translator into English that I know of in the 70s, he did the wisdom chapter as prose in the form of a debate between philosophers, because he couldn't do it as verse, he couldn't encapsulate it. So anyway, there's one verse in here, which I'll talk about if we get to it, where there's more than one interpretation. I had to pick one, but that one's definitely not finalized. So it's all like, probably nothing is 100% final here, but some of them I've had for years and I've recited for years. So yeah, the main translations I used were the three that I have. There's also this beautiful, if anybody really wants to get into it and knows some Tibetan, there's this lovely two volume, what do they call it? Engaging in the Conduct of the Bodhisattvas. It's published by Sechen Kunshab Ling, and it's translated by a Tibetan teacher and an English, you know, one of his students, I guess. But it has two volumes, and one volume is the verses in Tibetan and English. Not the most elegant translation, but it's a very good translation. And then the other is commentary, which I haven't read so far. So there's a lot of versions out there. All right, so let's, whoops, oh okay. Oh, interesting. I'm just playing with the mouse now to see what's happening. All right. So we begin with the first chapter. And these are my translations of the chapter titles. Like, they're translated in various ways. Chapter one of the 10 chapters is the benefits and advantages of bodhicitta. Like, why is bodhicitta important? Why do we want to train as a bodhisattva? Okay. And so as was said by one of the sources that I looked at, we're starting at the very beginning of the path here. And we're going to work our way up to the wisdom of recognizing emptiness in chapter 10. So we're gonna chant these together. Okay. Gonna chant these together. And so I've translated just a few. This is like one benefit. Okay, I've translated five verses in this chapter. So let's just chant it. There is a tune. I'll chant it first one time, and then everybody's welcome to chant along. You can chant as I'm doing it to demonstrate too, because nobody can hear anybody else anyway. And the underlines are where it's not necessarily clear in English where the which syllable is going to be stressed of the first two syllables. So it's not bodhicitta, wakeful mind, because that makes the meter not work. It's bodhicitta with the underline in the on the first syllable. So that's why the underlines are there. Okay, here we go. Bodhicitta, wakeful mind, is known in brief to have two kinds, the mind aspiring to wake up, and then the mind that really does. Okay, let's chant it together. Bodhicitta, wakeful mind, is known in brief to have two kinds, the mind aspiring to wake up, and then the mind that really does. So this is pointing out a really important thing. We're getting into, I cannot see everybody on the screen. I don't know. Now I see why. Oh, I can't seem to make it so I can see everybody, which, oh, here we go. Okay. They changed the user interface, at least in my Zoom account, the user interface is different than it used to be. So I think I can see everybody now. Okay, so what does this one mean? It's pretty obvious, right? So it's giving us a definition of bodhicitta. And it's making a distinction in that there are two kinds of bodhicitta. We all probably all know this. Do you know, anybody know what the two categories of bodhicitta are? Yes, Megan.
Is it relative and ultimate?
That's not the one. I was thinking that as you were raising your hand, is that there's two ways of dividing it up. Bruce, you have something?
Oh, the first is called aspiration bodhicitta, and I think the second one is called application bodhicitta.
Yeah, application or action. I call it action bodhicitta, application bodhicitta. And so that's the two categories. You're making that was a perfect answer. It's just not the category that this verse is about. So what is bodhicitta? It's the mind that wants to wake up. It's the mind with the intention to wake up. To wake up, why? In order to eliminate one's own suffering and to eliminate suffering for all beings, like to help all beings travel the same path. So before you undertake something, you have to know why you're doing it, right? Or you have to know what it is. Sorry, you have to know what it is. So bodhicitta is the mind that has the aspiration that wishes to wake up from the dream of samsara. And that's as far as we've got here. And it has two subcategories. The mind that wishes to wake up, that's one, but then the mind that really does. And we're going to get more information on that. So it's one thing to have the intention. And it's another thing to actually put it into practice and train in it. And the teaching of the Buddha is, if you really want to wake up, you have to also do the practice. You have to really do it. So second verse, let's chant that. The difference between these two, those who are wise must clearly know, just like the wish to take a trip is not the same as doing it. So the example that's always used for aspiration versus action bodhicitta is, you could think that you want to go to, what's a place? Maybe we'll go to Kathmandu instead of Paris. I always say Paris. You might really want to go to Kathmandu and maybe study with Mingyur Rinpoche or Sony Rinpoche or some other teacher who's in Kathmandu. But it doesn't get you there. Like the aspiration does not get you there. You still have to like research how to get there, decide what method of transportation you're probably going to fly. You have to get the plane ticket. You have to actually pack and get on the plane and go. So that's the path. The aspiration is what initiates the path, and the actual path is doing the actual things that you need to do. So let's chant that one more time. The difference between these two, those who are wise must clearly know, just like the wish to take a trip is not the same as doing it. Yes, Dan.
And you know, at least from my own experience, is that there is an enormous difference between, for example, studying everything you can about Kathmandu and actually doing the work,
yes,
which is meditation. And I think that's the essential difference, is that even though I could study everything there is about Kathmandu, I really don't get to experience it until I actually get on a plane and get there. And I think that's the trap sometimes Westerners fall into, is that, you know, we have a tendency to study something and think that we understand it without being able to take that experiential leap, which is sometimes scary when we start looking at our own minds.
Yeah, very well said. That's exactly it. And what we're going to see in these verses, I've said that I recommend picking a verse or several verses that really speak to you, that you'd really like to practice, and memorizing them and remembering them throughout the day. But then you have to try to actually do the practice. Like, you have to understand the meaning of it and actually try to do it, which is a very different aspect. But we do like to study a lot and get a lot of teachings and get empowerments. And then, but we then have to follow through with practice if we're going to actually get anywhere. Okay, any questions so far? I think it's pretty straightforward. Yes, Jean, what have you got?
I want to make sure I'm clear on this. Okay, so the mind aspiring to wake up, I get that. And then the mind that really does, and the same as doing it, which are obviously parallel, is the mind that really does. We're not talking about the mind that's achieved this, like the absolute mind. We're talking about us as practitioners.
Right. Yes, that's it. We're talking about, say, getting meditation instructions and aspiring to wake up and getting meditation instructions, then actually sitting on the cushion like a day
okay.
after.
Okay. So it's not, the implication isn't that it's the enlightened mind, it's the mind that's on the path.
Right, it's the mind that's on the path. It's called, like Zhang Chup Sem literally is the mind of enlightenment, but doesn't mean that you're already enlightened, although in the Vajrayana, we understand that we are, like, basically enlightened, and we just have to recognize it and operate from that, which is a long undertaking. But what it really means is the mind that wishes to wake up in order to help all beings wake up.
Okay, thank you.
So the terminology, like wakeful mind, it's really hard. It's really hard to do this in like a couple of words. It takes like a whole sentence to explain what's meant by enlightened mind. Some people say the mind of enlightenment, but I don't think that really helps either.
Oh,
it takes more words in English, I think. Yeah.
I think I understand that. Thank you.
Yeah. Very good question. Thank you. I think we probably needed that clarification. Okay. Anybody else before we move on to the last three verses about the benefits and advantages? Okay, here we go. Okay, these are lovely verses. There are actually a lot of very lovely verses in this chapter, and I've translated other ones, but I had to pick just a few for this. All right, next one. Let's chant that together. The mere intention to wake up can bring about a great result. But merit in a ceaseless stream needs action, bodhicitta mind. Same point, a little elaboration on the same point, that even the intention to wake up is really powerful. Even just having that genuine heartfelt wish is a very powerful thing. But if we really want a ceaseless stream of merit, and that's going to be explained in the next verses, if we really want a ceaseless stream of merit, we have to also have action bodhicitta. We have the mind that will put it into practice. And the practice is like, what are the paramitas? The paramitas are the action plan for bodhicitta. Like, you do it through generosity, practicing generosity, ethical conduct, patience, perseverance, meditation, and wisdom. That is the path of action bodhicitta right there. So we need to actually practice those things. Okay, next verse. And these two verses go together. They're separate verses, but the first one runs into the second one. It's one complete thought. When irreversible resolve combines with bodhicitta mind, with the intention to set free beings throughout infinity, from that time on a steady stream of wholesome merit unceasing, even in sleep or unaware, vast as the sky, will flow from there. So we chant it, and then we probably have to think about it a little bit. I find that there's sometimes two separate functions for me. So the irreversible resolve is the intention to wake up. And here, bodhicitta mind, I think, means the mind of action bodhicitta, the mind of intending to really do the thing, really intending to wake up through practicing. Let's see, when irreversible resolve combines with bodhicitta mind, with the intention to set free beings throughout infinity, that is what bodhicitta is. It's the mind that intends to wake up so that we can help other beings also free themselves, and they are limitless.
All limitless being, like no exceptions. We want everybody to wake up, and we want to be able to help everybody wake up. That's our aspiration. From that time on, a steady stream of wholesome merit, unceasing. So that's what's referred to in verse 117. Merit in a ceaseless stream needs action bodhicitta mind. So from that time on, a steady stream of wholesome merit, unceasing, even in sleep or unaware, vast as the sky, will flow from there. So it's like there's an explanation in the texts of why people take vows. Like, if you're not going to kill beings anyway, if you already have the intention not to kill beings, why does it help? What difference does it make if you have a vow to not kill or not? And the way that it's been explained is that the vow is actually considered a material, like in the Abhidharma, a vow is considered to be a material thing. It's like, it keeps working even when you're asleep. So you're getting the merit of your intention not to kill, or your intention not to steal, or your intention not to lie, like all of those vows that you can take. The merit continues to flow even when you're sleeping. It's not only when you're avoiding stepping on a bug. And a lot more could be said about any of these. We're just planting some seeds here. Anybody have any comments or questions before we move on to the next one, next chapter? So basically the idea here is that, what are the benefits and advantages of bodhicitta? So the preamble is, bodhicitta has the two parts, so it's not just the intention to wake up, but it's the following through of practicing in order to wake up, can result in a ceaseless stream of merit all the time, even when you're sleeping. Whoops. And merit, so why do we care? Like, who cares if we have merit or not? Lama Norla used to always say, in the early days, you people really need merit, because we had trouble getting things done, kind of. It's like merit is, it's the fuel that propels our journey. It's this energy or force that we acquire or accumulate or awaken by engaging in virtuous activity. So, and it all starts with arousing the mind of awakening, the mind of bodhicitta, and then acting on it. Okay, chapter 2 is a very strange chapter to me. It has good verses in it. Most of it is, it doesn't really say exactly. Most of the verses are about what's going to happen to us after we die, and that we're impermanent, everything's impermanent, so that we don't know when that's going to happen. So basically the idea of confession is something that especially monastic Buddhists do a lot. Like, there's a long confession prayer, the 35 Buddhas, that's recited every morning at the monastery. And we confess things that we've just done. Who are we confessing to? We're confessing to ourselves, really. We're acknowledging, we're bringing it like into our consciousness that we did something that maybe we spoke harshly to someone, or we took something, some trivial thing even, that was not given to us. Or maybe we accidentally killed a bug. Or maybe we had sort of ill will towards someone, which, you know, we do sometimes. We recognize those things. This is the four powers in the Vajrasattva practice. It's that four-step confession or acknowledgement of ways in which we have failed to live up to our aspirations, and that is to recognize it, resolve never to do it again, and rely on refuge. And what's the fourth one? Anybody's welcome to help me out here. Fourth one is
regret.
Yeah, that's in there. Yeah, so right, that's the second one. I wasn't planning to talk about this, so recognize and acknowledge it, regret it, like regret. You have to really think, oh, that I harmed somebody. I'm really sorry that I did that. You have to think about how it harmed somebody. And then you resolve never to do it again. Even if you know that you probably will
because nobody's perfect. You still make that resolve and it interrupts the habit that causes that particular action to happen. And then you rely on refuge and remedies. So, and through that process, Anne.
I just have a question. In my copy, I wrote under confession in parentheses, generosity. Is that?
Yeah, generosity might be in there. Generosity, it doesn't have its own chapter, and it pops up here and there. I didn't actually manage to get okay. any verses specifically about generosity. So I don't know why it says, is that maybe from the Terragar course?
No, I wrote that, so I don't know where I got that.
Yeah, but you must have heard it from somewhere, and yeah, it's quite possible it's in there. I will actually take a look and get back to you on that. What I found, I kind of skimmed a lot of it because I was just looking for verses that really spoke to me and I wanted to translate. So I didn't necessarily pay close attention to the ones that I was pretty sure I wasn't going to include. So most of it's about cleaning up your karma, and that's how we do it. So we confess things we've just done that we're really aware of. We confess things that we may have done inadvertently and we don't know. We confess things that we did in the past and in past lifetimes. It's just like this blanket confession of everything. Like we regret stuff that we did 3 lifetimes ago or 100 lifetimes ago that we don't even know what it is. We just really regret that we've ever caused harm to anybody. And that's how we clean up our karma. But most of the chapter is really about coming to really recognize that we don't know when we're going to die or when our circumstances will change, like recognizing impermanence. And that is our spur to do it now. Like, don't put that off. Clean up your karma now. So I've picked 2 verses on impermanence that I particularly liked. So let's do the first one. Okay, I really like this one. It's just a reminder of impermanence, but it's really poignant to me. Okay, right here. Those I hate will cease to be, and those I love will cease to be, and I myself will cease to be, and so we all will cease to be. That's about, like, that's a very stark, you know, acknowledgement of a reminder of impermanence. Let's do that one more time. And we can think about it, like, who do we hate? Who do we love? And hate's a strong word. Anybody that we feel the slightest aversion to falls into this category. And so you could kind of perk up at that one a little bit, maybe. Like somebody who's doing a lot of harm, well, they will eventually cease to be. That can bring a certain comfort. Although if you think about their karma, then you can only feel compassion toward them. Those I love will cease to be. That's sad. I myself will cease to be. That's scary. And it applies to everybody. Everybody's going to cease to be. And if we think about history, like previous generations, they all had lives just like we do. They all had day-to-day worries and day-to-day to-do lists and day-to-day failures. And they lived like each moment just like we do. And now they're gone. So we too will fall off that cliff. But our mind will go on and we will either become Buddha if our practice is really, really strong and everything goes perfectly, or we'll have another lifetime to keep working on it. So let's chant that one more time. Those I hate will cease to be, and those I love will cease to be, and I myself will cease to be, and so we all will cease to be. We can just take a moment to be with that thought. And then the next verse is going to build on that. Everything I have enjoyed is like a memory or dream. All things past will fade like this, never to be seen again. Everything I have enjoyed is like a memory or dream. All things past will fade like this, never to be seen again. A lot of the verses in Shantideva are also echoed in the 37 practices of a Bodhisattva, which came like 8 centuries later. Probably, I'm sure he was influenced by Shantideva. But there's a corresponding verse in the 37 practices for many of these verses. This is like, I think this is verse 4, where you think that all your family and friends are going to You can't take anything with you. You have to leave family and friends behind. You have to leave all your things that you've worked so hard for behind when you die. Like, it will all be gone. So this is, so first, we and everybody are going to cease to be. And then everything that we've ever experienced is already gone. We're like on this razor's edge of the present moment. Like, everything, what we ate for breakfast today is like a memory now. When back in the days of audio tapes and Walkmans, there was a brand called Memorex. I don't know if it's still around in some form. And they had this motto that I really liked. Is it real or is it Memorex? I think that was it. Is it live or is it Memorex? Maybe that was it. Same thing. It really makes you think, like, it's gone now. Like, the words that I just said are gone. They're just complete. They're in the recording now. So we have a little modern tweak to that. In some form, they can be preserved. They couldn't in the time of Shantideva. But it's all, everything is gone. Things that we take so seriously. So sometimes it's like what we're going to have for breakfast. Like, no, do I feel like pancakes or do I feel like eggs? Or, you know, it's like this hard decision. Lama Norla used to say that Americans, like, they take so much time deciding what to order in a restaurant. Like, they have to get the exact right thing. And then after you eat it, it doesn't matter which thing you ate. It's gone. Okay, any comments or questions on the confession verses, which are really the impermanence verses? Okay, do we want a break now or do we want to keep going?
Cool. I could actually use a little bit of a break. My tumor is beginning to get a little sore.
Oh,
I just
sorry.
Need 5 minutes to, I think I just sent you a text.
You sent me a text. I don't have my phone handy.
No, on Zoom.
A chat. Yes.
Chat.
Actually, I'm not. Oh yeah, I can see it now. It's not in the same place. I probably won't see chats.
I vote for a break too. Thank you, Dan.
Let's have a break. Yeah, I think probably a lot of people might.
I just need 5 minutes to.
Yeah, 5 minutes. We will reconvene at 3:10. So that's actually, oh, so sorry. Let's say 3:10. That's 6 minutes. So see you in a few minutes. And contemplate, you know, impermanence. Okay. Hey, Ann. How's the weather in Kittery Point today?
Just rainy. Did you get snow?
Oh, yeah. Not a lot, but the other ground is covered with snow.
Yeah, we got schlock, mostly rain, but yeah.
We got some of that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're pretty close. We're often very close to the rain-snow line here.
Yeah, maybe not close enough.
It's totally spring here. All the trees are in full bloom. Wow. The daffodils, the forsythia. Yeah.
Oh, stop bragging.
It's a lovely time. This is my favorite time to travel to Richmond in D.C. to see my brother, see Marilyn and Patrick, see the Richmond Sangha, because it's the end of, like, from the end of March through April is just so gorgeous. And there's no, we won't have leaves on the trees until May.
The leaves are coming out here too. This is early for us.
Oh yeah, it's been warm in some places. We're still quite cold here. The crocuses won't be up for, do you have any crocuses or daffodils, Anne? Or is everything still under snow?
No, my daffodils are up and, you know, budding.
Yeah, wow.
Ones that, I have them up against the house, so they always come early, yeah.
Actually, we haven't quite, everything isn't quite out yet. We've got a couple weeks.
Yeah.
We have aphids and crocuses, and I just saw snowdrops today in my yard.
Oh, nice.
It's like the things are just leafing out, but you're not missing everything, Mama Linda, yet. But come down anytime, man. We'd love to see you.
Well, you know, it's just things coming up and starting to bloom. Yeah, I know I never see everything, but it doesn't happen here for a while yet.
Snowdrops is so beautiful.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, I love them. They're so pretty.
I need to plant some.
I planted these years ago, and I think I originally planted more, and they've probably been eaten or whatever. We have bulls and moles and whatever. Whoever eats the, you know, things underground is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not to mention squirrels that dig up everything.
All right, shall we get back to Shanti Dave? Anybody else have anything they want to share before we do that? I think everybody's mostly back, maybe completely back. There's Kurt. Just checking. Oh, yeah, something else. Okay. Okay, so we are up to chapter 3, commitment to bodhicitta. So we're still like girding ourselves up to begin the action plan. But this is a very strong aspiration. It is a beautiful chapter, really beautiful. It has a lot of beautiful verses, and I had just had to pick a few. I think I have forgot how to get to the next page. Oh, like that, right there. Okay, I have 1, 2, 4 verses. Okay, but they're amongst my favorites. These are aspirations we can make. They're just all-encompassing aspirations. This is like the heart of bodhicitta. This is what we wish. If we could completely eliminate every suffering of every being, we would do that. So we start with people who are sick in verse 3.8. As long as any being is ill, till every sickness has been healed, may I myself take care of them as doctor, nurse, and medicine. These all speak for themselves, so I don't really need to explain a lot. Next, people who are hungry and thirsty and they don't have. I have a Tibetan language tutor in India, and I'm, you know, taking a Tibetan course in my fifth year now. And there was a sentence in the materials that we had to study where there was a sentence in Tibetan and it was a question like, will you do something? You'd say no, and you had to give a reason for it. And the first sentence was a mother asking their child if they've washed their hands. And the child says, no, and I'm not going to wash my hands because water is rare and we must not waste it. And so I was kind of laughing about that. You know, yeah, I guess water is rare. It's mostly not rare here, although out in the West sometimes, like, you know, Colorado and other places, they've had some water shortages, Arizona, New Mexico. And he said, he lives in Dharamsala, and he said the water is rare. there, and they don't have any water right now. Like there's no, there's, I mean, I'm sure there's places you can go to get some water, but there's no water. He hasn't been able to take like a shower in days. And it will come back. It has to do with rainfall and, you know, such. But so, I mean, there are a lot of people in the world that are really sad. We know a lot of people who are sick. I mean, we pray for Dan every day, for example. You know, as long as Dan is ill, till every sickness has been healed, may I myself take care of him as doctor, nurse, and medicine. We know people who are sick. We may not personally know so many people who don't have food or water to drink, but there are such people. There's a lot of them. So verse 3.9. And oh, sorry. In every place where famine strikes, may I turn into food and drink and come down as torrential rain to ease the hunger, thirst, and pain. And then 3.10, for, oh, it looks like it's split, right? Oh. For beings destitute and poor, may I become a treasure trove of everything they need and want, appearing right in front of them. And now sort of the underlying aspiration. To benefit all sentient beings, I give my virtue of 3 times. I offer, holding nothing back, my body, goods, enjoyments. So we would get, we would be doctor, nurse, and medicine if we could heal people. We would be food and drink if we could feed people and, you know, overcome their thirst. We would give them whatever they want. For beings who don't have anything, for beings who are very poor, may I be everything. May I be become, may I literally be everything that they need, and may they have it. And then the last one, there's nothing that you would not give up to ease the suffering of another being. Now, we don't have the capacity to do this right now, and that's fine. Tsongkhapa Rinpoche says we have to also remember our limitations, and we, you know, not try to extend ourselves, at least not far beyond what our actual capacity to help is, because then we burn out, because we're not in touch with that unlimited capacity yet. That's what we're cultivating on the path. But we would give everything. You give your virtue of the 3 times. It's like all the good deeds that you've done to help yourself, you know, eliminate your own suffering and wake up. You would give that away if it would help somebody else. You would give away your body. And there are stories of bodhisattvas who have done that, like the Buddha himself in a previous lifetime, his last lifetime before he was Buddha, ran across a mother tiger who was starving, and her cubs were starving. She didn't have any milk because she was so hungry. And he sacrificed his body. He cut, like his arm, he cut part of his body so that she could lick the blood and have the strength to finish the job so that she could live and her cubs could live. Like that's our ultimate aspiration. We give away our body. We give away everything we have. Remember the verse 12 in the 37 practices. What do you do if somebody breaks into your house and steals everything you have? You would give that away to help others. And enjoyments, like all the pleasures that we have in our lives. We go to movies, we eat good food. You know, we hang out with friends. We would give that away if it would help others. Fortunately, we don't have to give all those things away. But that's our aspiration. And sometimes situations do arise where we are called to give something. Maybe it's just our time. Give something that's hard to give. And then we can think about these verses. And then we make our decision, can I actually do this or can I not do this right now? And if we can't do this, then we aspire. There's our verse. We aspire to be able to do it in a future lifetime. Let's chant this group one more time. Does anybody have any comments or questions on it before we do that?
So can't do it now. It's like there's two reasons for that. One is that we don't have the actual capacity, and the other is that we can't want to do that. And that's like the really tough one.
What is the second one again?
That we can't want to do it. We want our own stuff too much. We
want. Oh,
our
we can't want it. Oh,
right.
Oh, right.
And so, my well, I don't know my. The way I'm questioning here is how to get ourselves to think of our, maybe it's like getting to think of our own needs as being so important in the view that we've developed somehow that we can do that without not wanting to do it. I mean, we can beat ourselves over the head to give away stuff that we like, but maybe it would be better to like realize that there's no point in holding on to it. And that's really, I think, the tough thing. And I think Mitchell Repuse talked about that in his book about In Love with Life, at some point in there, like, you know, if I remember correctly. But that's the big question, how to be able to want to do it. You know, not being able to physically do it, we just can't, we're not even doctors, not much less medicine. But to want to do all these things, to really want to do them, rather than just knowing we ought to want to, seems to be the key point here to me.
Yeah, really, really good point, Bruce. And in fact, I think it was Pema Chodron, one of the things that I read about Shantideva and this book, said that Shantideva did not think of generosity as giving things away. He thought of it as just not being attached to things, like cultivating the capacity to not have attachment. And I think that's maybe getting to the point of your question. It's just all about doing the practice, studying the texts, learning the verses, wherever that's appropriate, taking them to heart. We cannot force ourselves, for example, not to be angry. We can't, it's counterproductive to try to force that, to try to block anger or try to like make ourselves give away something that's really precious to us. And it's better not to do that. There's actually in the, where is that? It's in the right commentary on the generosity paramita in Gampopa. That there are wrong ways to be generous, like there are inappropriate ways to be generous. And one of those is not to give away something that, say, is important to someone around you, that would it would pain them if you gave it away. So I think we have to respect that in ourselves, too. And that's what Sonia Rinpoche is getting at when he often reminds us that we have to act within our capacity. It's if it feels really painful, then we haven't actually gotten the point of it, because the point is to cultivate the mind of generosity that is not attached to things. And so we give away things. I mean, sometimes circumstances dictate otherwise, and we do have to give away something that's a little painful, and we can do that. But generally, ideally, generosity, like ultimate generosity, according to Gampopa, is you give something away and you don't feel any attachment. It has to have value to you. It has value. To be a full generosity, it has something has to be have value, and you but you can you have to be able to give it away without attachment to it. And we want, I mean, that's a process of getting to that point. So yeah, there will be pain involved sometimes, but we just don't want to try to force it. We have to go with what we can do. I don't know if that responds fully to what you're bringing up, but it's a really good point to think about. Yes, Dan.
And you know, when you talk about the example of someone like breaking into your house and taking things from you and you know, just giving it to them, how do you balance something like that? Like, even if it's something like more emotional, for example, or somebody that's really giving you a difficult time right in the moment, how do you balance that between not allowing them to commit a negative act or not allowing them to, you know, increase their karma, you know, by allowing them to engage in a negative act and maybe, you know, having a, you know, either giving them a consequence for that or just drawing back because you're trying to protect yourself and the other person from themselves, really.
Do you have an answer to that, Dan? I mean,
honestly,
I have a feeling you do. What would it mean? Somebody breaks into your house and steals stuff. What does it mean to have the like aspiration or the ability to wish them well, to wish that it bring happiness to them, to like not be attached to the stuff? Like, but what's the right thing to do in that situation? Is it to just let them have it? It might not be.
Oh, I don't think it is. I think
yeah,
sometimes
it might not be.
I think sometimes you need to draw a line, whether it's physical
yeah.
items or taking advantage of you emotionally.
Yeah, yeah.
Or anything. Like there are times when you need to have a hard stop and say, no, this just isn't okay. This
yeah.
isn't okay for me and it's not okay for
yeah.
you. And
so,
that's actually a more compassionate act.
Yeah. So what do you think Tokme Zongpo, the author of 37 Practices, what do you think his point is? Is it that we should just let people get away with it? Because he has all those examples in the boot camp. Somebody says something bad about you that's not true. You see them as your teacher. Like,
I think it's I think it's more of internal growth.
It's more what?
I think it's more internal growth. I think it's working with your own mind and recognizing the non-attachment, but also taking appropriate relative action.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I knew you knew. But we have to think about this again and again. This question comes up for us almost on a daily basis. Like, what is the correct response to this thing? Like, what is the bodhisattva response to this thing? What is the bodhisattva response to somebody breaking into your house and stealing all your stuff? Dan has excellent points. He might steal somebody else's stuff. And the more he steals, or she steals, or they steal, the worse it is for their karmic situation. So I know multiple people in here. Anybody else want to answer this? Like, what is the heart of this? In terms of the 37 practices, it is that we cultivate a compassionate mind. We might need to call the police and turn them in. That's definitely a thing that we might need to do to save other people from harm, to get our stuff back, maybe. Maybe there's some really important thing that they stole that really, you know, we really need to have back. And for their karma. Yeah, Jean, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm thinking I've been robbed a few times. Burglarized, not unfortunately not mugged or something, but you know, people broken into my place and they took stuff that I did indeed value very, very much. But I will say, after all those years, I don't really care. I mean, I wish they hadn't done it, you know, but I don't really care anymore. And maybe that's a good thing to keep in mind, that, you know, I'm not talking about like emotional thing, like an exploitative relationship. I'm just talking about stuff.
Yeah.
You will not care about that stuff 10, 20 years from now if you're lucky enough to live on. And if you look at it from that perspective, it does kind of take the edge off of being attached to stuff. I mean, I'm super attached to everything I have now. You know, I'm not trying to pretend.
No, me too. I have lots of attachment.
Take the edge off, because you know that 10 years from now, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah. This
I just want to say something. Okay. You told me years ago, they really stuck in my mind, of how when you go on retreat, at first, like, I'm not sure if you were talking about yourself or someone else who had told this to you, but at first you think about things a lot, like you think about the home you've left a lot.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of fades off and
you
just become occupied with retreat. And that whole house and home just doesn't have the same grip on you.
Yeah.
And I thought about that a lot. You told me that many years ago, and I thought about that a lot.
Yeah. Well, my story on that is, when I was in three-year retreat, it's really true. You're thinking for a while about what you've left. It's like your mind is very active about stuff that you were concerned with before. And then it fades. And I, in my youth, was a big baseball fan. I don't follow it anymore, but I went to baseball games. You know, Richmond had like the farm team won down from the Atlanta Braves. So some really great baseball players played in Richmond, Virginia. And I went, I listened to games on the radio. I was a Mets fan. I don't know if like you're Mets or Yankees. People are Mets or Yankees. I'm a Mets fan. And I lived in New York City. And they won the World Series the year Zoe was born, 1986. But I forgot, I didn't realize I had forgotten about baseball. And it's not something I actively thought about. It was really from my past. But Yeshe Palmo, who was our retreat caretaker, she would go to KDK in New York City to teach on like Wednesday nights. We would take turns, you know, people who'd been done 3 or 2 would take turns going for a month at a time to teach. Dan was there. He was always there. And so she came back one Thursday morning and she said, she told us, and I don't know why she said this, because she was so careful about not sharing stuff from the outside world. Because in retreat, you're not supposed to hear anything about anything. You're supposed to be focused on your practice. She said that she didn't get any sleep the night before because people were out in the streets like making a lot of noise, and she had no idea what it was about. And then the next morning, her host, which I think was Lydia Saltzman, told her that the Mets or the Yankees, one of them, had won the World Series. And I heard World Series, and I could not compute what that meant. Like, it meant nothing to me. I had no, like, immediate association to it. And then all of a sudden, it's like, baseball! And I just thought about every thought I'd ever had about baseball. Like, the Mets won the year Zoe was born. It was like my mind was flooded with these thoughts. But it had faded. And that is this verse above, 236. Let's chant that one again because it's right on topic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a couple of people probably need to mute. Okay, everything I have enjoyed is like a memory or dream. All things past will fade like this, never to be seen again. So it's the same thing. So there's that. But so what is the point of, like, what was Tomei Zangpo thinking in these Bodhisattva boot camp verses where people are doing all kinds of things to harm us and we're just supposed to see them in a positive, like the generosity one, the generosity verse is like, if somebody steals everything you've got, then it's exactly the same as this verse. I offer holding nothing back, my body, goods, enjoyments. You're supposed to think you give them everything freely and all of your virtue and everything you will ever have, you dedicate it to them. May they have it. May it solve all their problems. May they be happy. You still might call the police, because the point is that we look at the situation with compassion instead of being angry and having a grudge and you're going after this person with the mind of vengeance. We think they must be in some really terrible situation that they need to steal things that belong to other people. And that's what's in our heart, is compassion as much as possible. I mean, it's not gonna be perfect at our stage of development, but we cultivate that thought. And then we call the police if we need to. We do what we need to do to help ourselves, to help other people, our neighbors, to help the person with their karma and so forth. So in all of those situations, we have this really compassionate response instead of sort of taking it personally and dwelling on the harm that has been done to us. We think about the other person. We think, well, the whole point of having a guru is that they, you know, they point out our faults. So if some other person points out my faults, I should see them as my teacher. You might have to correct them, though. You might have to correct it, like, to other people who have heard it, just depending on what it is. Like, the highest, you know, response is like we don't even care. But there might be some reason that we need to, or even for our own peace of mind, we might need to point out that they were wrong, but we still see them internally as having benefited us because they spurred us to have a compassionate response, which is the response of a bodhisattva and not the response of somebody really totally stuck in samsara. So any further questions? I think we may not get through all the verses today, and that's fine. We can do the rest during whatever we don't get to today. We'll do the rest in our next workshop if people want to continue with it. You know, if this is enough, Shanti Deva, that's fine. But anybody have any further questions or comments on that particular question? That's a great question, Dan, and great observation, Jean. It really does fade. Like the less we're invested in it, the more time passes, the more it fades. What was important to us 20 years ago? Like, do we even remember? So important. We were so worried about it. We were so fixated on a particular outcome, and now we don't remember. Okay, so we've had, like, the benefits of bodhicitta and the benefits of, and that we need to remember impermanence. That's our spur to practice, to actually train as a bodhisattva, to do the practice. We will cease to be. We don't know when that is. And everything that we treasure now, all the things that distract us from Dharma practice right now, all the activities we engage in, they're just going to be memories. Like, as soon as they're over, it's just a memory. That Taylor Swift concert that cost hundreds of dollars to go to, and everybody was so excited about, now it's just a memory. It's like you didn't even go. You might as well have seen it on TV, except I'm sure it has more personal meaning than that. But still. All right, so let's go on to carefulness. Carefulness, this one has a lot of titles. I just went with carefulness. chapter four. Okay, this is about, this is really getting into ethical conduct. I think four and five are really ethical conduct, but they're not called that. All right, so let's just chant and see where it takes us. So 4.2. Bodhisattvas who have grasped the meaning of bodhicitta must strive to keep it constantly and never let their practice go. So that means it's not going to be like that, like at our stage, probably at my stage, not like that. I have to keep remembering. I don't keep it constantly. There are moments when I'm not acting in accordance with my bodhisattva aspiration, I'm not speaking in accordance with, or I'm not acting in accordance with, or I'm not thinking in accordance with, but we just have to strive to remember again and again so that it becomes a force that carries us along through merit ceaselessly, even when we're asleep. Like the more we stay in touch with it, the more that actually happens. It all, like the force of our bodhisattva aspiration and activity becomes like a really, becomes like a river, like the rapids at Pony Pasture enrichment. Like it just carries you along. So we just want to remember as much as possible that this is our aspiration and to act in accordance with it. If somebody steals all our stuff, it would be nice if we could remember, like, oh, yeah, I can do what I need to do about this. I can take an action to prevent this from happening to somebody else. I can take an action to get my stuff back. But I'm going to remember that this person who stole my stuff is suffering. Like that's, and I wish them well. I wish them to have everything they need. That's the bodhisattva mind. Oh, this was one of my favorites. This is really good, maybe counterintuitive advice. Like it's a thing that happens to us and we're not sure necessarily how to go forward. And Shanti Deva has a definitive answer for us. Okay, 4.2. For something recklessly begun without full consideration, even if promised I should stop and give it conscientious thought. Let's chant that one more time. For something recklessly begun without full consideration, even if promised I should stop and give it conscientious thought. It's a little clunky in the consideration, but you know, we do our best. So that means you promised somebody that you would do something and you plunged into it, you know, because you thought it was a good idea, because you wanted to do it, because you promised that you would do it. Like this happens to me. And then you think about it and you realize that's not in accordance with my bodhisattva aspiration. Like this is not something I should really do. So you're weighing the promise or the having begun something, having set something in motion against like what the result is going to be in terms of if you carry it through and you're having second thoughts about it. And Shanti Deva says we should reconsider it because verse 4.2 must strive to keep it constantly and never let their practice go. We don't want to act contrary to our bodhisattva training. I'm not saying what the right answer would be. I mean, maybe sometimes the right answer is just to go ahead. Maybe harm is minimal, or, you know, there's reasons why we need to finish the job. But Shanti Deva says we should take it seriously. We should reconsider if we realize that we have done that. Any questions or comments on that one?
Are they both 4.2?
No, they're not. I obviously have a typo in this one. I don't know what it is, but I'll correct that later. Thanks. I can't change it now. But anyway, yes, thank you, Michelle. Okay, next one. Okay, it's 4.46, verse 46 in chapter 4. Oh, wait a minute. There should be more of these. So, yeah, somehow I have a... This is somehow the breaks in this are not the same as in the they were before. But anyway, there's more in, along these lines. But let's do this one, 46. When harmful reactivity is exiled by my wisdom eye, can it return to harm again? only if I allow it in. So that's, we've made some progress maybe with like feeling anger. Like maybe somebody stole all our stuff and we were able to let it go, like take whatever action we needed, but in our mind, in our heart, let it go and feel compassion. Like, is that thought of anger going to come back? It will return to harm again, but we have to let it, we have a choice. We may not be able to see that option at the time, but if we're examining our mind, which is the next chapter, like really examining our conduct moment to moment, then we have the choice to not let that anger back in. So when harmful reactivity is exiled by my wisdom eye, and that's literally the words in the verse, can it return to harm again only if I allow it in? So we always have a choice. We don't always, sometimes the reaction is so quick that we don't see the choice. But when we do see the choice, we can choose not to let it back in. You know, it's good sign that we were able to short circuit it earlier. When harmful reactivity is exiled by my wisdom, I means I see it. I see it coming and I'm able not to act on the anger that comes up. And I'm able to connect with compassion or whatever is the appropriate response. But it will come back. It will try to come back. There will always be more opportunities to be angry or be greedy or be impatient, whatever. And we have the choice. And so we, as aspiring bodhisattvas, we want to choose to stay with compassion to whatever extent's possible. Again, we're always operating within our capacity. We can't forcefully block stuff. The anger might, and we can feel the anger. It's not wrong to feel the anger or feel the attachment or whatever it is. Feelings are never wrong. What we're inhibiting is reacting to a situation from that emotion. We want to be feeling compassion, but recognizing the situation and responding to it appropriately, however it may be, forcefully, whatever is needed. Is that one clear? Anybody have any comments on that one? Okay, we're coming down to the last 15 or 20 minutes. We'll see how, I think we'll get through the, okay, so get through this one and maybe vigilance. And then there's, that's exactly half the book. It's more than half the verses that I have. Okay, next one. Oh, this is an analysis of harmful emotions that I really like. And I could not do this one in 2 lines. Okay. Harmful emotions, where are they? Not in objects or faculties, nor are they somewhere in between. Where do they dwell to harm beings? Have no fear, they are a mirage. Just get to know them as they are. Since there is clearly nothing there, why should they make my life such hell? So this is an analysis. This is actually Vipassana verse. This is an analysis of what is the nature of emotions like anger and so forth that come up and make us suffer a lot. And if we look at them, if we analyze them, if we're angry, I don't know, I'm going to say I'm angry at my phone. That's what I get angry at, is like my phone or my computer, mostly. Is the anger in the phone, like the thing that has offended you, the person that's offended you or the object that's offended you? You don't find it there if you look. Is it in your senses, your sense faculties? Is that where it is? You can't find it there, but you have to look. And you don't always see, sometimes it looks like it's in a particular place, but you have to keep analyzing it. So is it somewhere between those two things? Is it happening in the space? Is the actual emotion itself in the space between like your bodily sensation of it and the thing that's making you angry? And then you ask, where is it? Like you find that it's in none of those places. You can't identify it as being actually in any of those places. So where is it? It doesn't exist. It doesn't have an actual sort of physical, it's not an entity. It's nowhere. It's like a dream. And so how do we deal with that? How do we deal with emotions when they arise? We can't find where they're located. We can't find the one who is experiencing them. So the solution, the practice, is just get to know them as they are. It's this is where we just rest with the emotion that we are feeling. And we see that there's nothing there. So why does it bother us so much? I mean, we could analyze any situation in our life like this. If I can't like find where it is, why is it causing me so much suffering? So you may or may not love that verse, but I find it very helpful. And then the last verse that I translated in this section on carefulness. Reflecting thus on this advice, I'll practice now with diligence. Was any patient ever cured by disregarding doctor's words? So this is the situation of, it's the same as exactly his advice at the very beginning. Like there's a difference between getting, aspiring to something and acting on it. Same thing, you're sick and the doctor tells you to do something. And if you just listen to the advice and don't actually put it into practice, if you don't take the medicine or refrain from the thing that's causing your physical, you know, illness, you're not gonna get better. So even if we listen to the advice, like really, you know, with great eagerness, and then we go home and we don't do it, then nothing's gonna happen. We're not gonna get better. Okay, anybody have anything they wanna say? I think I only have one. Oh, I have two verses in vigilance. So maybe I have more. Oh, yeah, I have a few. Okay, I think we can do vigilance and then we'll just stop and see if anybody has anything they wanna talk about. Any questions or comments on the carefulness verses? And again, I will send these. I'll send all of them to Jean, and she can put them on the website. You can download them as a PDF, and you can work with them. You can study them some more, work with them. All right, vigilance. So vigilance and carefulness. So we have actually three categories of how we, as an aspiring bodhisattva, someone who wants to wake up, someone who wants to see reality as it is, someone who wants to get out from under the control of our emotional reactivity. There's three parts to what we need to do. And so mindfulness is not specifically here. Vigilance is actually a little different from mindfulness. It's Shesen in Tibetan. Mindfulness is Drenpa. And I forget what carefulness is. So mindfulness is knowing what you're doing, right? Vigilance is knowing what you should be doing, like recognizing like whether you're acting in accordance with the practice or you're not. And carefulness is then bringing your actions into accordance with what you know is actually the way a bodhisattva should be acting in this situation. So three components. So vigilance is, and again, I would put this verse 5:13, the first one, I put that in the patience chapter myself. I don't know how that's vigilance exactly. So, but it's one of my favorite verses, probably the first Shantideva verse I ever translated. We might talk about this one a bit. All right, let's chant this one. Wherever could I find enough leather to cover all the earth, yet I can get the same effect just wearing leather on my feet. Let's chant that one more time. Wherever could I find enough leather to cover all the earth, yet I can get the same effect just wearing leather on my feet. Anybody want to explain this one? Like just what the meaning of it is? Nobody has to. Oh yes, Macon.
Like you're never gonna be able to get everybody to like act the way that like makes you calm. But you can control how you react to like things that annoy you or whatever.
I could not have said it better. Thank you, Macon. You said it better probably than I would have. Yes. So what is the basic cause of our unhappiness? What is the basic cause of samsara? Like being stuck in samsara? It's wanting, it's thinking that our happiness depends on external circumstances. All the teachers talk about, this is the beginning of Bokhar Rinpoche's book on meditation, Advice to Beginners. He starts off by saying, why? We all want to not suffer. Why do we suffer? And we suffer because we think that our happiness depends on that person not saying that thing to us, or, you know, our job being not that, or that person at work who never does any work and it falls all on us. We want to change that person. Can we change that person? Probably not. Can we change everything that's going wrong in our lives? There's no way, right? Wherever could I find enough leather to cover all the earth? How could I change all the situations in my life so that I could be happy and calm? It's not possible. I love the analogy here of the leather, or think of it as vegan leather, like if you're vegan. It's like whatever it would take. It doesn't have to be cowhide. but, you know, they didn't have other things. They had no plastic in 8th century India. They wouldn't have used cowhide either, though, probably, because India is mostly Hindu and cows are not. Cows are sacred. But anyway, put on your own shoes. Like, just get somebody to make you some shoes, and that will insulate you from all the gravel that's hurting your feet. So I love this verse. This is the first verse I memorized. This is the first verse I translated. I love this verse a lot. Anybody have any comments or questions about this one? I recommend memorizing this one. If you like it. If you don't like it, there's other ones. Okay, next verse. Okay, so this one is, these are definitely vigilance. These three are vigilance. And this is the we get to do the stick of wood today before we have to end the discussion. Okay, let's do these three. Well, let's do the first one first. So this is what vigilance means. This is the thing. In meditation, I won't lose my focus even one instant. By asking what's my mind up to, I'll constantly examine it. This is the final verse of the topic is the same as the final verse of the 37 practices. To put into practice all the 37 practices, it all hinges on whether we know what we're doing, whether we know whether our conduct, our thoughts, our speech, our actions are in accordance with the conduct of a bodhisattva that we're aspiring to. How do we know it? We keep our alertness as much as possible. Again, we're going to lose it a lot. But as much as possible, we stay tuned. Like when we feel a reaction coming up in our mind, like an emotional reaction, some anger, some jealousy, some, you know, what else is there? Some arrogance, like whatever it is. We're looking at our mind as much as possible. We're being aware. And that's where we see that because we're doing that, we see we have an option. So I won't lose my focus even one instant means I will stay in contact with what my mind is doing. What's my mind up to right now, right now, right now, right now? I'll constantly examine it. And then we know, we see anger coming up when it's just the tiniest little bit of irritation. And that's when we can say, I don't want to go down this route. But often because we're not noticing, our mind is distracted into an object of some kind, into the situation. It's not, we're not looking at our internal, like what's going on internally with us. And we don't notice that anger coming up until it's pretty full blown. And then it's very, very hard to not have an angry reaction, to get to a compassionate reaction and then take whatever action we need to from the point of view of compassion, still doing whatever hard thing needs to be done. So this is really, this is a really demanding. This is the discipline of the paramita of ethical conduct. This is where it's discipline, is the discipline of always staying in touch with what's happening in our mind so that we know when an emotion is coming up that we don't want to act out of. How not to act out of it is coming in the next two verses. Let's chant that one more time. In meditation, I won't lose my focus even one instant. By asking what's my mind up to, I'll constantly examine it. So it's talking about meditation here. That's where hone the skill. This is where we cultivate the skill. It's like things in meditation, nothing's happening outside. We've isolated ourselves as much as we can just for that period of time. And so we're just looking at our mind. It's much harder to do out in the world in the midst of situations. So we work on it in meditation. But now we're probably getting into situations in verses 48 and 52. Let's just end with those two. Whenever in my mind I feel a tracing of anger, a trace of anger, wait a minute, whenever in my mind I feel a trace of anger or craving, I will not act, I will not speak, but like a stick of wood remain. We talked about the stick of wood recently in Meditation Lab, I think. So we're not perfect yet. That anger is really strong already. And we can't channel it into compassion yet. So what's the solution? It's like you just go into gray rock mode. You know, I mean, you just don't react at all. Because we can do that. We can inhibit reacting at all. This is one time when blocking something is okay, because we're examining our mind moment to moment, and we're going to watch that emotion now that we have recognized it. But you recognize it, and you just can't be a bodhisattva in this moment, but maybe you can be a stick of wood and just let it pass, because we know that it will pass, because everything is impermanent. Everything is a memory in the next moment after it happens. So that's our first objective. Later, it'll be more refined. But right now, it's just like, just don't say anything. Don't do anything. Just be here. Like, use all of your energy to just be here and not react. And same thing in the next one. When care for others is displaced by wishing to seek my own gain, I won't so much as speak of it, but like a stick of wood remain. So it's the pie. It's the pie analogy. Everybody who's been like hanging out with me for the last 20 or 30 years knows my favorite dessert is pie. I never eat it anymore, but you know, because you get old and like you don't deal with things like that so well. But there's one piece of pie left. And maybe you didn't even have any pie yet. There's too many people for the pie. And there's only one piece left, and you really want that piece of pie. But you see, this is a very worldly example. You see that somebody else didn't have any pie yet either. And they maybe it's a six-year-old child, and they really want that pie too. And you just like what comes up for you is like you want that pie. And what you do is like you let the other person have it. Maybe you can't do it out of generosity yet, but you can inhibit running forward and beating them to the pie and taking it. So anyway, I think we have to stop now. But we will go on. Let's see, screen 7 of 9. So yeah, we don't have that much left to do next time. So the first question is, and we don't have to answer that question. I'm going to stop the screen share. I'll share again for the dedication. Do we want to do the rest of the verses next time, or do we want to do a different topic and everybody can just study the verses on their own?
Let's do the rest of them.
Okay. You don't have to say that out of politeness or anything.
No, actually, you really would.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
you too.
Okay, great. We have word also from Popong Shempantarchen, our host. So yeah, we'll finish them and we can talk more about the whole thing. Maybe I'll have a few more verses by then, because this is really the most fun thing I do. And then again, they're not perfect yet. A lot of them are not finalized. So there can be some clunkiness. Sometimes I can't avoid the clunkiness and they stay clunky, but mostly I think they work. You get the kind of playful quality in some of them. Okay, anybody have any questions or comments before we do our dedication? Do you feel that this is something you'll be able to use in your life? Do you feel like you want to like memorize a verse? and like, well, that's what I do, is like I will take one verse and I will just chant it like here and there throughout the day. Wherever could I find enough leather to cover all the earth, I can get the same effect just wearing leather on my feet. That's one of my favorites. And the next one coming up in the Patience chapter is my other is another of my favorite, and I'll leave you with that one. If there is a remedy, why any anxiety? If the problem can't be fixed, how does worry help with it? Like, we never need to worry. That's the other one that I remind myself of a lot. All right, any comments? I keep asking for comments and then talking, so I'll be quiet for a minute, and if anybody has anything to say.
Yeah, I had a really interesting moment with Norman Norlin in Portier a while back, you know, when he was talking, when we were talking about anger and emotions and stuff like that. And we were signing like a petition for, you know, teachers to be able to travel from India. And there was this whole thing about, you know, I happened to be at the monastery that day, and there was a whole lot, you know, of we were doing like a, I don't remember who it was to, like the Indian government or something like that. And we all signed off on it. And Rinpoche, I mean, he was very articulate and very, you know, expressive about the fact that this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But the next second, he was like, okay, like it wasn't controlling him. Like he was able to express his displeasure and his concern about a situation to other people. And if you came in that moment, you would have thought he was furious. But the next moment, he was, you know, completely onto something else. Like it hadn't affected him, but he was effectively able to tell people that, no, this is not okay. What is going on is not okay. This is hurting people. This is not something that's acceptable. But he wasn't allowing it to control him. He wasn't bottling it up. But at the same time, he wasn't allowing it to control him. And I found that very interesting when we were talking about, you know, anger and, you know, talking about how people can, you know, express that in sort of a healthy way, or sort of our healthy sense of self without necessarily losing ourself in it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the advantage of having a living teacher with a lot of realization, is you can, sometimes you can actually see that happening. You can see them. You can sometimes, I'll tell a story about color imaging. I think, Jean, did you have your hand up?
I just want to say, Dan, was that the time that Karmapa was going to come to KTC, and they ended up taking him over to KTD instead? And I saw him do that. I don't know if the same event, but it's like...
Well, that was a different one. The driver came very late, and it looked like he, unfortunately, was going to like tear the driver's head off, but it was all done with compassion. No, this isn't okay. You messed up. We have, you know, Karmapa is waiting. But at the same time, you know, he wasn't being controlled by it, but he was able to express the fact that, no, this is hurting people. What you did is not acceptable. But at the same time, he wasn't being, I remember both incidents, actually.
He wasn't losing his temper.
But he wasn't losing his temper. He was simply able to tell somebody that, no, this is hurting other people. This is hurting me. This is hurting whatever. But it's not out of control. It's like it was coming from a place of compassion and caring, but at the same time, it was very clear that, no, this is not okay. You hurt people by doing this.
This is what we aspire to. Anything further, Bruce?
Well, this was the time, this was not a driver, but this is when we had thought that Karmapa was coming to our monastery, but instead some of the political things got him to go to Woodstock instead.
Okay.
And I sat there, I was in the entryway to the old building, and it's like watching him, like, this is very interesting, you know, watching him be a little wrathful there, like, this is just wrong, but next time we'll do it, but next time we'll make sure it happens right for us, you know, it's like,
Yeah, Dan, I can picture him exactly the way you're describing.
Yeah.
I've
been on the receiving end of that.
Oh,
you feel it.
I was too once or twice.
Yeah, you also feel the compassion. Yeah, anybody who's involved in running a center, I don't know, Jean, you guys always do such a great job. New York City Center, you know, maybe, I don't know. They also had very good people. But I personally, you know, I've always been like part of the staff at the monastery, and I've definitely made some mistakes. Or seen something differently than he saw it. Like, I didn't think I really made a mistake, but he was like, you know.
Yeah.
But I always felt the compassion. There's seeing the process. Like, sometimes you can get a glimpse of the process. Like, you know, something's arising and they just There's a, for those of us who knew Kala Rinpoche, you can probably envision this, and you might have heard the same story, but I've heard the story, I think I read it in a book, that, or was it Situ Rinpoche? I think it was Kala Rinpoche, maybe it was Situ Rinpoche, I'm sure he showed it with Kala Rinpoche, that he was just sitting, you know, with some people and just perfectly calm, and then somebody, like just how they are, sort of imperturbable, cheerful, imperturbable, and somebody like his driver, or some, I think his driver came in and told him that there was some situation, like it, something was going to be late or they weren't going to make something or something like that. And whoever witnessed that said that they saw this momentary expression on his face, just this momentary reaction on his face. And then it was gone. Like it was gone immediately. Like he had, it was like he had some kind of internal, like, oh no, or, you know, I don't know whether it was like angry or whether it was like distress or what it was, but it was gone in a flash. And I think that's the process we need to look at, because the reaction's gonna come up. We're gonna have reactions to things, especially we're not anywhere near the level of these lamas yet. We can get there by following this path. But that's what we're looking for, is that moment when the reaction comes up. That's like why we're as mindful as possible and as vigilant as possible, to see it when it comes up and then be able to catch it like before it's full-fledged. That's like amazing if you can do that. I miss that most of the time. Every once in a while, though, I see myself be able to do that. Like, oh, okay, it's just gone. And it's like, well, how did I do that? How did that happen? I don't know yet. But anyway, it's why it's great to be able to spend time with these teachers. Yes, Jean.
I know we're trying to wrap up, but I will say sometimes when that happens, you know, when I'm actually able to not react in situations, particularly, you know, with another person, afterwards, I think, well, that worked out so much better.
Yeah.
Than if I reacted. And I think, like, I would encourage people, maybe, you know, stop me if this is wrong, but, like, I kind of feel like we should go ahead and give ourselves not exactly a pat on the back, like I'm so great.
Yeah.
Just to think, wow, that went well, because it encourages you.
Yeah. I think that. I go, wow, I did it that time.
Yeah, yeah. And then the next time, you know, it kind of reinforces the lesson.
Yeah. And it makes you realize it is possible. Like even for me, it's possible to sometimes catch it.
Yeah.
Even most of the time I miss it, it's possible to catch it. And how can I be so aware enough next time, and the next time I totally fail. And that's fine, you don't beat yourself up. It's like, this is a process and it's really hard to do this. Our emotional reactions are so strong and so like habitual after many lifetimes. Bill Amanorlo always said, after 20, you've been building this habit for trillions of lifetimes. So, you know, you can't like solve it right away. And but that's the verse, like if the problem can be solved, if there is a remedy, why any anxiety? We don't need to worry about it. If the problem can't be solved, you know, how does worry? If the problem can't be fixed, how does worry help with it? So no need to worry about it if we fail. Mm-hmm. We'll have lots of fails. But catching that, some of the advice that we get in the Lamrim text and all those sort of guides to the path is, like every night, like every morning we make our aspiration, you know, like the walk for peace, right? It's like today is going to be my peaceful day. We set that intention. And then at the end of the day, before we go to sleep, we're supposed to look at our day, reflect on our day and go, oh yeah, failed that one. And they would have piles of dark rocks and light rocks in the caves. And then dark rock if they failed, and white rock if they, or light colored rock if they did something right. And so you're always hoping that the light pile will get bigger and the dark pile will get smaller. But it's actually considered very, very constructive to our path if we reflect like that at the end of the day. And you definitely get to go, yay, I got a light rock. I did that right. I could have hurt somebody's feelings, and I didn't. All right, well, we're past time. Anybody else before we do the dedication? I hope this was helpful. I hope you know, make use of the verses. I know I am. I really enjoyed like working on this month, pulling all my stuff together, translating a few extra verses. All right, well, I will screen share one more time. We'll do our dedication prayer. We're just going to do it one time in Tibetan, once in English, really. Oh, the dedication. Let's also do, after we do this dedication, we're just going to take another minute and do Shanti Deva's dedication, which is the last verse in my translation document. Because he has a very beautiful dedication. But first, we'll do ours. O sonam di tam che zipani, tot ne ne pedranam pamchene, che ana chi balap chupai, si bait sole drowa drowar sho. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may all sentient beings be free. Okay, I'm going to share my other document. There we go. And just go to the end. Oops. Here's the dedication. Very beautiful. Pema Chidrin uses this dedication at the end of every teaching session. My translation is a little different. Hers, the one she uses from Padmakara, is also very beautiful, and I'll share that next time we meet too. All right, so last one, dedication 1055. As long as sky and space exist and beings are still wandering, for just as long may I remain, dispelling all their suffering. Thanks everybody for coming. Macon, how long are you in Mexico for?
I leave tomorrow. Today is my last day.
Aw, how long have you been there?
I got here on Wednesday. So
Wednesday, okay. So you had
it's been a nice trip.
That's nice. I'm glad you got to go. I'm glad you're recovering from your injuries.
Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Okay, bye everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Paul Pung Shipman, Tarchin, Jean, and Bruce, for setting up at Ekoji, and for always being here and being so reliable, for all the work that went into it. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you so much, Lama.
Bye.
Thank you, Lama.
Thanks. Bye.